In his talk today, Dr. Rahimi will be speaking on the Iran nuclear crisis toward a diplomatic solution. Dr. Rahimi will examine recent developments in U.S.-Iran relations in light of the historical and political relations between the two countries and internal developments within Iranian politics, and will offer some recommendations for U.S. policies that could support diplomatic solutions to the current standoff. Dr. Rahimi's work complements other work that USIP has been doing, particularly in our Conflict Analysis and Prevention Center under the program series directed by Scott Lisensky on Iraq and its neighbors. We have a number of publications that have been produced in this series, and I invite you to take a look at the table outside, where in particular I would call your attention to a special report authored by Jeffrey Camp entitled Iran and Iraq, the Shia Connection, Soft Power, and the Nuclear Factor, published late last year. We're pleased to provide this forum for Dr. Rahimi to discuss his research. He hails from Iran and has traveled extensively to his home country, where he conducted informal interviews last year and earlier this year in Tehran, Isfahan, Qom, Kermanshah, Bushehr, where one of Iran's nuclear facilities is located, Shiraz, Khorramshahr, and Abadan. Last summer, he also traveled to Iraq, where he spent time in Basra, Diwania, Najaf, Karbala, and Baghdad. Dr. Rahimi recently received tenure as a professor of Islamic studies at the University of California at San Diego, where his main research focus is the study of state and society throughout Islamic history, in particular the formation of Islamic public spheres. Dr. Rahimi's writings include journal articles on Iran and Islamic history, including Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani and the Democratization of Post-Saddam Iraq, a comparative study of the Ottoman and Safavid origins, and cyber dissent, the interest in revolutionary Iran. Dr. Rahimi was a visiting fellow in the Department of Anthropology at the London School of Economics. He was awarded travel grants from the American Political Science Association and the American Sociological Association, and he received a fellowship from the European American Young Scholars Summer Institute on Secularization and Religion at the University of Erfurt and the National Humanities Center. He holds a PhD from the European University Institute. Now, before turning over the podium to Dr. Rahimi, I just ask that you kindly turn off any electronic devices you have, including cell phones. These will interfere with the system that is currently taping today's program. The event is being recorded live and will be available later from the USIP website at www.usip.org. And now,
Thank you. I do want to make a note that my first year at UCSD, which is actually the first year I taught ever, was not rigorous. It was a nightmare. I almost had a heart attack. So just want to make a note of that. But I mean, I love teaching, but it was just really intense. I used to have a friend. I don't know where he is now. At the university where I used to do my graduate years, it was UCSD. He used to tell me that politics is about the art of maintaining power and resisting power. Well, I really wish I could find them because I want to add something else. Really, politics is also about the art of making people really confused. And this is a good example of here, the Iranian nuclear crisis. What's going on with the Iranian side, the domestic Iranian politics, but also the U.S. domestic politics as well. Now, what I want to do today is tell you why I'm kind of confused about this. Not necessarily confused, but I want to definitely bring out the reasons why I've been so surprised for the last few weeks or so. When I was presenting, or actually I gave the possibility of presenting this paper, I remember emailing you, I wanted to do something about, of course, you know, the idea of diplomatic solution to this whole Iranian nuclear crisis. This was before June 6th, and of course what I wanted to do, I wanted to criticize the U.S. administration for not directly engaged with the Iranians, and I had a whole list of arguments, and of course my argument wasn't anything original. I was going to basically repeat what other scholars have said in the field, people like Farid Zakaria, you know, Berzinski, and a number of different scholars who've been basically asking the U.S. to very much, you know, directly negotiate with Iran. That's really the ultimate and the best solution in this conflict. Well, June 6th comes, and I'm eating my breakfast in the morning, and suddenly I hear Dr. Rice talking about, you know, clearly saying that, look, you know, we're going to actually negotiate with Iran. First, actually, I got very upset at Dr. Rice for ruining my presentation today. Second of all, this is great, but what I was hearing from Dr. Rice, the first thing came to my mind is that Iranians are not going to accept this. the kind of conditional negotiation, the sort that would ask Iran to stop, at least temporarily stop, its enrichment of uranium itself is not something the Iranians would accept. Bear in mind, when I say Iranians, I'm talking about very much the hardliner conservative faction of the Iranian government here, which are very much dominating Iranian politics at this moment. And third of all, I really realize that with the sudden change of U.S. foreign policy, we are seeing a radical shift in U.S. politics at the moment. This is fascinating. 2003, we had the so-called new conservative takeover of the American government, which, you know, a lot of idealism there about spreading democracy in the region. But now we are shifting towards a more pragmatic conception of dealing with countries with so-called broke states like Iran and, of course, North Korea, which is not a topic for today. But anyway, I'm sure we'll get to it in the Q&A session. That was my first reaction. You know, I was a bit surprised, but at the same time, I did not think Iranians would accept this. Now, this is what the incentive basically includes. Again, that's another thing. I don't think anyone is exactly sure what the incentive package is includes, but this is what the six, you know, powers we're talking about, Germany, France, Britain, U.S., China, Russia, and the U.S., have offered to Iran. June 6th, Javier Solano offers this incentive package to Iran. It includes economic incentives, mostly helping to build Iran light water nuclear reactors, allow Iran to buy spare airplane parts. This is actually very important for the Iranians. They have a lot of problems with this part. And also even support Iran to join the World Trade Organization. This is what I know so far. And I'm sure there are other economic incentives involved in this one first section of the package. Now, the second one is some security guarantees. At least, and this is exactly, I'm not sure, but my hunch is that there is some guarantees or security guarantees that the U.S. would abandon its policy of regime change, perhaps cooperate to a certain extent in the Persian Gulf region with the Iranian military to a certain extent, you know, doing away with that kind of belligerent, I guess you could say, aggressive regime change policy that the U.S. especially has adopted after 9/11. Well, they had this even before 9/11, but definitely has intensified. Now, the Iranian reaction was surprising. I mean, I really was surprised about it. This is why I'm talking about the confusion, was that, you know, I did not think they would say this, but here you are. This is Mr. Ali Larijani, who's a very major, important politician in Iran, and this is what he had to say about the package. He actually said this in Egypt. It has been said that the proposals included both incentives and punishments, but what we received was just a plan with positive points. And I'm like, this is interesting. This is an interesting development here. There's a possibility that this incentive package is working, and the Iranians are very much taking this diplomatic route. September, June 16th, again, we are seeing this is Iran's President Ahmadinejad. We are hearing him how he is welcoming the package of incentive. He calls a step forward. You know, we even have Mr. Sam Butman, hopefully I didn't mispronounce his name. He's actually saying that apparently Iranians are going to reply very soon. And Mr. Ahmadinejad later on says that, well, actually Iran will respond by August 22nd. Well, this in itself was problematic for certain people in the administration, but at least there's something going on. There's a diplomatic progress going on. June 17th, suddenly, I mean, we're just talking about, just a day. Things are changing a bit. Now Iranians are saying, well, there's some ambiguities in the incentive package, but we're going to amend some of those parts, and we're going to offer our own package to the Western countries, of course, including Russia and China. In the end, we will present our proposal. It's a two-way street, Mr. Manoucher Mottaki, Iran's foreign minister, would say. But suddenly, this is what's so confusing. In around 10 days or so, this is Mr. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He's the supreme leader of the Iranian government. This is what he said. Negotiations with America does not have any benefit for us, and we do not need such negotiations. Now, I want to make a note. This is not an absolute final decision by the Iranians regarding to the incentive package. But, I mean, this is the leader of the Iranian government. He's making a statement like this, a very negative statement about the incentive package. Something happened. Something happened within these 10 days that the Iranians decided to change their mind about it. Now, again, I want to make sure that everyone knows here that I'm not saying that this is the absolute final decision, but definitely things are changing. Now, what I want to do in this presentation, whatever time is left, I want to talk about this. What is going on in Iran's domestic politics? And why this sudden change in attitude? I want to talk about this. And also, ultimately, I want to offer some solutions to this, you know, sudden problematic development that we see happening on June 27th, which was actually 2 days ago. But anyway. So, just, you know, before I actually talk about the whole, you know, situation here, especially Iran's domestic problems or politics, let me talk about a very brief history of Iran's nuclear program. Well, originally, Iran's nuclear program was developed in the 1950s. Actually, it was very much helped by the U.S. government at that time. And we are seeing how in 1959, this is really after the overthrowing of Mossadegh's regime in 1953, we are seeing the Shah's government actually establish a Tehran Nuclear Research Center. Again, this is very much being supported by the U.S. government. 1975, this is a few years after Iran actually signed the NPT. This is the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We see this interesting agreement between, well, Mr. Henry Kissinger signing this National Security Decision Memorandum 292, which again gave more support to the Iranian government to develop its nuclear technology. Under President Ford, you have the U.S. increasing assistance to the Iranian government to advance its nuclear program. What's really ironic is that some of the people in Mr. Bush's administration at the moment, people like Paul Wolfowitz, Mr. Rumsfeld, and of course Mr. Dick Cheney, at that time they were very much encouraging Iran to develop its nuclear power or nuclear technology. And it's ironic how history changes things. But anyway, there was a 1979 revolution. The nuclear technology development was kind of abandoned by the Iranians. There was the Iran-Iraq War. And 1984, we have the Iraqis basically damaging the Bushehr plant, and I think there's a map that is going around. Bushehr basically situated right in the Persian Gulf region is like this, the southern Iranian city, port city, and that was damaged. So that was really catastrophic for the Iranians and their ambitions to develop their nuclear technology. However, after the Iran-Iraq War, this is 1990, Iran began to develop this nuclear program. It's becoming more ambitious. We have someone like Mr. Rafsanjani, who's actually talking about how Iran has the right to develop nuclear weapons, not just technology for civilian purposes, but also nuclear bomb for its own security, given the fact that, this is what he argued, the U.S. has had a very aggressive policy against the Iranian regime. 1995, we see Iran signs a contract with Russia to resume work on the Bushehr nuclear plant. This is that famous Bushehr plants in the southern port city of Iran. Now, here, again, I don't want to go too much in detail. There's a lot of history. I don't want to bore you. But ultimately, what we're seeing is that 2002, the MKO, this is the Mojahideen-e-Khalq organization, a dissident organization we'll actually talk about later on, represented by Alireza Jafarzadeh, he reveals the existence of two, basically, unknown nuclear sites, actually underground nuclear sites. This is in the city, the location is in Natanz and Arak. I'm sure you'll see that in the map I passed around. Basically, Natanz is just a few kilometers away from the city of Isfahan. And by the way, Natanz is really the place that they're very much trying to, you know, advance the uranium enrichment process. This is really the most contentious nuclear sites right now. Now, in April 11, 2006, again, I'm skipping over a lot of historical detail, but we have that major declaration by the Iranian president, who was elected to be the new president in 2005, June or July 2005, where he declares that actually Iran has been successful to enrich uranium up to 3.5%. That's the legal limit of the NPT, but that in itself, raised a lot of problems for a number of people in the Western capitals, of course, including Washington, D.C. Now, this is the map of the different nuclear sites. I've seen some of these nuclear sites in Tehran. They're basically built around near civilian areas. But these are the main ones, Natanz and Arak. These are, especially Natanz is the main one, where a number of people have argued that Iran is definitely ambitiously trying to develop nuclear weapons by enriching uranium. And of course, Bushehr is right here. This is where, you know, I think by the end of 2006, the Russians are going to help Iranians to completely develop a nuclear site right here, the facility right here. Anyway, now, I would argue that by 2003, Iranians got really serious. to developing the nuclear technology. Two reasons, I would argue. One is mostly a foreign factor. I mean, you have the U.S.-led invasion in Iraq that very much radicalized and worried a lot of, especially hardliner conservative Iranians, and Mr. Ahmadinejad is included in that list, of course, for obvious reasons. You know, you have the U.S. troops in Afghanistan, you have now the U.S. troops in Iraq. Of course, you have a number of different U.S. troops and stations in Central Asia, in Azerbaijan, in some Persian Gulf states. So really, Iran is feeling threatened. They're feeling threatened, they're being surrounded. So, of course, the obvious move is to strengthen its military. That's really the only option they have. And, of course, this is why they're so interested in nuclear technology. But there's also a domestic factor. This has to do with the reformist and the conservative rivalry after 1997, when Mr. Khatami was elected to become Iran's president. We're seeing that from really 2000, especially 2000, all the way to 2004, we're seeing how the paramilitary faction, these are the Revolutionary Guard, and also the Basijis, these are the volunteer militia corps that work for the Iranian government, especially they're very much led by Mr. Khamenei, who's of course the spiritual leader of the Iranian government, they're very much trying to gain influence. What they do is that they kick out, through the Guardian Council, they kick out the reformers from the parliament, thanks to the parliamentary victory in 2004, where a number of conservatives were able to actually win seats in the parliament. And, of course, the most important victory for the conservative hardliner conservatives was Mr. Ahmadinejad's victory in 2005 presidential elections. Now, this whole thing is, of course, very controversial. People have said this was a kind of an electoral coup. Some have said that actually this was Mr. Ahmadinejad was elected thanks to his populist appeal, especially to the poorer sector of the Iranian population. We could talk about this different later on. But the whole point is that they were successful to politically manipulate and completely dominate Iranian politics. And also economically. Just recently I read an article how the Revolutionary Guard is kind of moving away from its military background, military in the sense of defending Iran from its foreign enemies, and moving mostly to economic infrastructure. They're very much signing up new contracts, very lucrative contracts, and they're making a lot of money. They very much have an interesting hand in Iran's economic infrastructure. Now, this is what I mean. This is Mr. Ahmadinejad, that's the general of the Revolutionary Guard. We are seeing this interesting connection with Mr. Ahmadinejad, who actually is very much part of the hardliner conservative faction of the Iranian government. And they have a very interesting connection. And this is, by the way, interesting. It's fascinating, the familial ties, the network connection, that, you know, this guy would actually allow his daughter to marry another Revolutionary Guard. And, you know, that kind of kinship connection is very much present, especially if you're seeing this after the Iran-Iran war, the Iran-Iran war after 1988. Now, the history of the Revolutionary Guards actually goes back to the student demonstration and, of course, the taking over of the U.S. Embassy in 1979. Most of the students actually later became Revolutionary Guards. And they were highly educated, of course, especially towards the 80s and 90s. They end up getting their PhDs. They very much became either technocrats, bureaucrats, or officials in the Iranian government. Mr. Ahmadinejad is a good example. He used to be a Revolutionary Guard in the 80s. In fact, as far as I know, he was actually very much managing, I forget, but whatever it was, he was part of the Evin, the infamous Evin prison in Iran, who actually, I talked to a Kurdish man, he said he actually saw Mr. Ahmadinejad not execute, but at least manage some executions in the Evin prison. So there's that dark feature of the Revolutionary Guards in the 1980s, and of course with the U.S. hostage crisis, and they're very much involved in that. Now, I had a chance to visit the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran. These are my photos. This is actually front of the U.S. Embassy, the wall right there. And of course, this has been completely defaced, the plague, but anyway. Now, inside the reason why I'm bringing this up, by the way, is because the Revolutionary Guard actually controls the former U.S. Embassy. They are the ones that actually put up this museum there, this anti-American museum in the U.S. Embassy, where they constantly monitor it, they administrate it, and they actually, you know, monitor who comes in and who goes out. I was happy to go there because I managed to take some pictures and I thought I could share it with you, but I want to show you that anti-American ideological foundation of the Revolutionary Guards, which possibly is one of the reasons why they kind of encouraged perhaps Mr. Khamenei to make a statement like that, the one I actually put up. But anyway, this is the famous American Marine who was, you know, arrested, I forget his name, but during the hostage crisis. But they have a statue there. There's also the American Statue of Liberty right here. And the body itself is shaped into a prison. So, you know, the paradox of liberty and domination. Anyway, this is actually, Persian says that these books represent the human rights decoration. So what they're trying to say is that human rights is just a ploy for the West to harm and decapitate the poor and the dispossessed people. So anyway, just part of the whole ideological rhetoric. This is the communication room. I thought to put a picture right here. This is what they did. When the minute the students came into the embassy, they tried to destroy this cabinet, which was very much secure. And of course, there were a lot of files here. So you could see still the bullets here and how they tried to actually access to it. But I don't know how they managed to actually break through this cabinet. And also, this is the back then, this were the computers they used to have. They're huge. Anyway, and this is just a bunch of bombs showing that the U.S. aggression towards Iran. Now, while I was there, I came out of the U.S. embassy, and there was this one guy. There was this one guy, actually Azeri Irani guy, that was selling a bunch of CDs right next to the U.S. embassy. So I went up to this guy, and I see Britney Spears CD. So I turned around and I said, you know, I picked up the CD and I'm like, so do you like Britney Spears? He had a huge smile on his face. He's like, absolutely, Britney Spears, he said in a very courageous tone of voice, will come and have a concert in the U.S. Embassy. I wish I could go back and find that guy. Britney Spears should not come to Iran. This would not be a good thing. That should be actually part of the additional protocol. Somehow there, that Britney Spears should be banned from coming to Iran. If things change. Well, anyway. There's other factor, the Basiji Corps. They're mostly a grassroots voluntary force that make up the Iran's hardliner conservative faction. And again, I don't think they have any important major impact in those, you know, kind of decision-making policies up there in the Iranian government. But definitely they have a lot of power in maintaining or imposing the Sharia-minded imposition of Islamic law, at least the way it's interpreted by the conservatives in Iranian society. You could definitely see them once you go to cities like Tehran, Isfahan. So they're very much there. I just want to put that up so everyone would see that. Now, you know, we're talking about really a fragmented government, the Iranian one. Just like, I guess you could say, the U.S. administration as well. You know, the division, so-called the division between the State Department and Defense Department. We see that also in Iran, of course, in a different form. This is Ayatollah Muhammad Yazdi. He's the clerical faction of the hardliners, who apparently is supposed to be the successor to Ayatollah Khamenei in case he passes away, he dies. He definitely is going to be, he's a potential candidate. But he very much is one of those really tough hardliner conservatives who absolutely does not want to negotiate with the U.S. However, on the other side, we have the so-called pragmatic conservatives, including Mr. Rafsanjani, who leads the movement, who says, oh, definitely we should negotiate with the U.S. It's actually in Iran's best interest to negotiate with the U.S. Now, recently, for the last few days, especially after the incentive offer, Mr. Rafsanjani has been very much courted by the reformists to come and join their party and their movement. Now, what's interesting about Rafsanjani is that he's a shrewd politician. You know, he could, I don't want to say change faces, but he definitely, just a good politician, he could move around and, you know, maneuver within the political Iran's political order. So this guy is going to probably play a major role in a few weeks to come. Again, I don't know, anyone else does not know, no one else knows about this, but this is the one guy we need to watch out for to see what he's going to do. Anyway, now the question is, in case Iran accepts the offer with some modification, what would happen? Again, I'm talking about Iran's domestic politics. What probably will happen, in case they do accept the package, again, we have to see, this is what's going to, probably another few weeks or so, we're going to find out what's going to happen. We're going to see definitely a less factionalist Iranian politics. That is to say, the Iranian government, I would say, will definitely get more unified, the pragmatists and conservatives, who probably will have the compromise over the incentive deal, they will be more unified at least, but also we probably will see a possible reemergence of Rafsanjani and the reformist Iranian politicians. Again, this is all hypothetical, but definitely I'll be more than happy to talk about this in the Q&A section. Well, also, of course, this is something many Iranians argue. I've talked to many Iranians, just everyday, ordinary Iranians. They definitely see that, you know, once Iran actually directly negotiates with the U.S., and perhaps accepts the incentive package, Iran will definitely join the global world, economic world, and become more internationalized in the way of dealing with different countries, especially the U.S., of course. Now, in case Iran rejects the incentive package, which at this moment it looks like that, well, I think it just goes to show the increasing dominance of the hardliner conservatives, especially the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Remember, they're the ones that are not losing. Actually, probably they will lose a lot if they do negotiate with the U.S. Why? Because economically they're secured. They're basically, they don't need to benefit from any other part of the incentive economic plan. What probably they will lose, of course, or will hinder, is basically the ideological foundation of anti-Americanism. That would really, they need to make some major compromises if that incentive package is accepted by the Iranian government. But I think also we will see an increase in factionalism. Now, with that whole heart, well, the conservative faction I just mentioned to you, people like Mr. Ali Larijani, who's actually the person I showed you earlier, he's definitely coming from that pragmatist conservative background. And you have people like, I guess you could say Mr. Ahmadinejad himself, or other members of the Guard Corps, who are actually in Iran's parliament, by the way. They already have won a lot of seats. I could see that there could be an increasing tension between the pragmatists and the hardliner conservatives in the Iranian government, which, of course, I definitely could see how violence could erupt in later on in the future if this thing happens. Isolationism, of course, is the ultimate thing that will happen. Iran, given the fact possibly Iran would be sanctioned by the Security Council, would become more isolationist, it would retreat from the global economic world. And again, these are just hypothetical arguments here. Now, three possible solutions I want to offer here before we move on to the Q&A section, or what I call disasters in the making. The first option, of course, is something you have here and there heard, the regime change option. You know, you have heard this from a number of people. Well, really, Iranians are not there to negotiate. They're too ideological. They're just too, they are not there to compromise. So what's the best thing to do? Change the regime. First thing, of course, you have the more moderate version of the military or the regime option. Call this the rice factor. Assistance to foreign and domestic pro-democracy groups in Iran. You have this famous $75 million promotion package of promoting democratic groups in Iran. This is, of course, this was actually a few months ago, a few weeks ago that this thing was proposed. And of course, you have the other very aggressive one, the military intervention. The argument is that, you know, sanctions won't even work. What's going to happen, the best thing is the military intervention. This is actually way more radical. The person I think is leading the argument is Mr. Michael Ledeen, I think that's how you pronounce it. Iranians are dying to bring down the government themselves. So that's the basic argument. That regime change, all the U.S. has to do is just go there and boom, Iranians will have an uprising and they will get rid of the regime, and that's the best way to stop Iran's nuclear program. I have a lot of doubts about this one statement, and we could definitely talk about this in the Q&A section. There's a lot of idealism here, the kind of idealism we also saw during the Iraq War. Anyway, now the problems with military intervention, first and foremost, it violates the NPT. It has a nuclear state attacking a non-nuclear state, and this in itself would undermine U.S.'s claim that Iran is violating the NPT in the first place. So this is highly problematic, I think, ideologically. And also, you know, the argument is that, sure, you could destroy some nuclear facilities, but ultimately this will not stop Iran's nuclear technology. It certainly would not. On short term, maybe it would hinder it, but ultimately it will not do anything. And I think ultimately, we're talking about the nationalistic factor, it definitely would unite a lot of Iranians against the U.S. I was traveling in the province, well, actually in the city of Abadan, in southern Iran, and I met this taxi driver. You know, I was just talking to him, and I do that all the time, by the way. It's really cool. If you want to know anything about countries like Iran and Iraq, talk to the taxi drivers. They're the best ones. And he said something interesting. He's like, you know, my brother was killed by the Iranian government. I hate the Iranian government, but I prefer the Iranian government to foreign troops coming and invading my country. I will actually go and fight with the Iranian government to fight, you know, against the U.S. I think that guy very much articulated the kind of nationalistic sentiment that is in Iran at this moment, against a possible U.S. military intervention in Iran. Of course, there will be the huge humanitarian catastrophe. You know, it's obvious that, you know, people, a number of scientists have talked about this, including some of my colleagues at UCSD, some of the scientists at UCSD, that there will be, of course, huge nuclear fallout. And because of the wind factor, a lot of people could get definitely killed in the west, but eastern provinces of Iran and all the way to Pakistan, who knows, even India. So this is a very dangerous option right here, I would argue. Now, I think this quote from a famous human rights activist, Ms. Shirin Ebadi, I think very much challenges the kind of military option. Billy Kozetz here and brinkmanship are what have brought us to where we stand now, but they remain ingrained habits from both sides. The threat of regime change by military force while reserved as an option by some in the Western world endangers nearly all the efforts of democracy-minded Iranians have made in these recent years. I don't want to explain this. I think this is pretty self-explanatory. But I just want to very much focus on the dangers of the military options in the democratization of Iran for years to come. So what or who should the U.S. avoid at this moment? The wannabe Chalabis, quite frankly. Now, I say wannabe, I don't want to be polemical, but definitely I think the wannabe Chalabis at this moment, the Iranian dissidents, some of them living abroad, especially in countries like the U.S., and some of them actually walking around the city of Washington, I think they could be there very dangerous at points. Now, the constitutional monarchist, Mr. Reza Pahlavi, I don't have anything personal against him. I definitely do not think that Iran needs a monarchy. But, you know, I'm just worried by the kind of some of the rhetoric I've been hearing from him. And I think this is one of the wannabe Chalabis I will be very aware of or be very afraid of. Of course, another wannabe Chalabi group is the Mujahideen Khalq organization, especially after 2003 when the U.S. invaded, the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. They were based in Iraq. Of course, they were being supported by the Iraqi regime. And now the question is, after the 2003, what happened to them? Apparently, most of them are based in Iraq. The leaders are basically scattered around the world, especially Ms. Maryam Rajavi. She's in France, I think, at the moment. And, you know, well, we could talk about it in the Q&A section, but definitely this is one of the groups that has been supported by some of the people in Washington, D.C. I don't want to name anyone. And this group is extremely dangerous, because really what they're arguing is that Iran should have some form of a Marxist-Islamic democracy, and of course she should be the leader of that kind of state. And what worries me is that some politicians have advocated this group to actually go to Iran and fight against the Iranian regime and gather information. If that is happening at this moment, I'm not sure, but definitely I would not recommend the U.S. to do that. Now, the sanction option, I think this, again, we're dealing with short-term solutions. One solution is that, you know, this is the best thing for the international community to do is to restrict Iranian officials to travel and live abroad and even invest outside of Iran. And I don't think that's effective. Yeah, sure, in short term, you could definitely hinder the Iranian government, but I don't think that would stop Iran's nuclear technology or the development of nuclear technology. Second thing is the energy infrastructure, sanction Iran's oil production. Well, sure, you could do that. Definitely that would hinder Iran's economy. And of course, that in itself would bring up the oil prices around the world. But definitely the first victims, I think, in this scenario are the Iranian population, not the Iranian elites. But at this moment, they have a lot of money already saved up in Swiss banks. Diplomatic solution. Now, we have the famous carrot-stick policy, of course. What we are seeing in the recent incentive, very much includes all of this. Again, I'm not sure exactly about this one, but it does definitely include the economic incentives, energy incentives, assistance for an Iranian civilian energy program, and, you know, to a certain point, and of course the security inducements, this is really interesting. I think Patrick Clausen recently, sometime in May, he very much was advocating this option. This is good, I would argue. However, by the way, there's a stick part to this. You've got the conditional aspect, the temporary suspension of the enrichment of uranium. This is simply to build trust so Iranians would confirm what they're claiming, that they're really for the nuclear program is simply for civilian purposes. And, of course, the multinational sanctions that would include, of course, China and Russia, that's the kind of thing if Iran does reject the nuclear or the package incentive action. And, of course, the option on the table, the military action, that would be the punishment in case Iran does reject the nuclear or the incentive package. However, I think there are serious problems with the stick part of the foreign policy, or at least the package or the diplomatic solution. I think first and foremost, it ignores Iran's uncompromising position on its NPT right to enrich uranium at home. This is central to the Iranians. That would also include ordinary Iranians. Iranians are not part of the Iranian government, and they very much, again, I don't want to generalize, but many Iranians very much share the sentiment that it is Iran's right to enrich uranium based on the NPT regulations. Now, of course, what this thing also does is that it ignores Iranian mistrust of the U.S. This is central. And I think this has been ignored by the recent incentive plan because, you know, what the Iranians are arguing is that, wait a minute, you know, you're talking about inspectors coming to Iran and the whole, you know, inspector regime process that we saw in Iraq. But look, this could be just a ploy for America to just, you know, gather more information, do extensive surveillance, use for broader intelligence, that, you know, eventually they could attack us and do the, you know, try to fulfill their ultimate dream to regime for a regime change. And of course, there's a nationalism factor. And I was looking at some of the part that actually the IAEA will come to Iran, they will inspect the different nuclear sites. And if any Iranian is looking at that, is reading the whole process, definitely they will feel that this is just a foreign occupation, and the kind of, you know, nationalistic sentiment that right now is in Iran would definitely harm that process. So anyway, these are, I think, the problems with the stick part of the package. Now, we are hearing the kind of rhetoric now. This actually was made in March 2006 when, I believe it was even Washington, D.C., actually the Iraqis were trying to have the U.S. and Iran to come negotiate over the Iraq factor. And this is what Ayatollah Khamenei said, even though at first they were kind of positive about it, but later he turned around and said, the U.S. must stop bullying the attitudes. So what he felt at that moment, and by the way, that's the reason apparently why we withdrew from the talks, was that, well, the U.S. is just being too belligerent. It's just being too aggressive. The kind of rhetoric we are hearing is unacceptable. Now, in June 16th, this is right, you know, just a few days ago, a few weeks ago, this is what Mr. Ali Asghar Soltani said. He's one of the ambassadors to the International Atomic Energy Agency. This is what he said. The carrot and the stick policy has always been counterproductive. In the case of Iran, humiliation and the use of language of threat of referring the nuclear dossier to the UN Security Council have had serious impact on mutual trust and confidence on parties involved and thus the process of negotiations. This is what he said. And I think it's central, and I think probably that's one of the reasons, one, not the only one, why Mr. Khamenei just recently backed off from the negotiations and said that this will not benefit Iran. Now, I think what's central at this stage is to modify the kind of incentive package. One of the things would be no conditions for negotiation. I know this is something that the administration would not accept, but, you know, I just thought to bring it out. The first thing I think is extremely important for the U.S. to simply, at this stage, to simply have the talks, to have the negotiations, and see where that goes. And I think this is one of the most important factors. Second is modification of delayed limited enrichment. This is where, you know, the kind of inspection regime will be going in Iran. And there's, I think there's 2 or 3 or 4 year process that they have to go through. I think that could be probably modified too. The NPT's additional protocol could definitely include a tough regime inspection, but should at the same time allow Iranians to produce or enrich the uranium, of course, allowed under the NPT. And I think, you know, we're talking about a really delicate change of or modification of the incentive package. But if that happens, and also if this thing happens as well, you know, reducing the rhetoric, reducing or toning down the rhetoric, I think that's extremely important. You know, we are hearing we're still hearing the rhetoric of regime change coming from the administration. Again, we haven't heard it for the last month or so, but it's still very much there. And of course, what the Iranians are saying is that, wait a minute, how could we trust you? You're talking about talking? I mean, how could you call out to talk to someone by the same time planning to actually kill them? You can't do that. That's a paradox in itself. But there's also the aspect of politics of recognition. What the Iranians are saying is that, you know, you have not, for all these different decades, you have not recognized, and in fact, you have gone out of your way to completely destroy us. I think it would be, now this is something, my personal opinion, quite frankly I say this, and for the moment I've just tried to give the scholarly point of view, but my personal opinion is that the Republican administration should apologize for the way they supported the Saddam Hussein regime in the 1980s. Mr. Gingrich was the only one that recognized the problem for the U.S., especially the U.S. administration, the Reagan administration for supporting Saddam Hussein, especially after 1984. And I think that would really be a huge step, just like the way Mr. Clinton apologized for the CIA coup of Mossadegh's government in 1953. That's the CIA-led coup d'etat, sorry. But I think this could be a huge step to building trust
mutual trust between the two parties. And I think I'll leave it there. So, please, this will be the Q&A section, I guess.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
How do you explain the campaign of Holocaust denial?
The campaign of Holocaust? I think, again, it has to do with bolstering the base. The argument is that one of the reasons why Ahmadinejad has become so, has kind of raised up the anti-Israeli rhetoric. It has to do with a way of bolstering his revolutionary guards, the base, basically the Basijis who are very much supporting him. And definitely is there. I was reading an article by the only Jewish minister or minister of the parliament in Iran's Majlis, and apparently he raised the point to him. He's like, you know, how could you deny the Holocaust? And what I read from that article, according to the Jewish prime minister or the minister of Majlis, apparently he kind of backed up and said, well, that's not what I really meant. So it seems like he just used it for ideological rhetoric, as far as I'm concerned. About the comment about the annihilation of Israel, I did some research. I didn't know about this till a few weeks ago. Apparently Ahmadinejad did not directly say that Israel should be wiped off from the face of earth. What apparently he said in Persian was that, following Mr. Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini in the 80s, was that Israel will be wiped off the face of earth in page of time. You know, the whole millenarian rhetoric that eventually Israel will be wiped off. Just the same argument perhaps the evangelical Christians here make about, you know, Israel will also be wiped off. And so again, this is what I'm understanding. Again, I never heard what he said exactly. But that's the other side of the argument. Yes?
Three follow-up with regard to that, but the Israeli press reported, I saw this in Haaretz a few weeks ago, that Iran has transferred to Hezbollah ballistic missiles capable of reaching virtually all of Israel.
I'm not surprised.
Combined with that.
True.
Yeah,
well, they were supporting. They've been supporting Hezbollah for decades. Yeah. So I don't see any major. It wouldn't surprise me as much. They've been helping them financially. They were helping them, and militaristically were helping them. I don't see how this differs from 1980s, quite frankly. Yes.
Thank you. You could identify yourselves also.
Oh, my name is Jason Crosby with USIP. Is there any in Iran's recent rhetoric and actions of building up the nuclear program? Is it tied in at all to their relations with Pakistan and the fact that Pakistan has a nuclear armed power?
Well, that's one of the arguments. The argument is that, of course, they don't explicitly say that, look, we want to have nuclear power. But what they're saying recently is that, look, Brazil is right now trying to enrich uranium to the level of 3.5%. Why can't we do it? So they're trying to give examples of different regions around the world and saying, look, and of course, they try to constantly show America's hypocrisy. For dealing, for instance, in the case of India. You know, that was definitely a violation of the NPT. So they constantly try to do that. But, you know, I don't think Pakistan is really that their central interest at this moment, you know.
Steve?
Steve Riskin, USIP. How aware is the Iranian public about this nuclear issue and this, what's viewed as a crisis in many quarters?
Sure.
What are their sources of information about this? And are there strong feelings?
Sure. The nationalistic sentiment doesn't necessarily come from the media. It just comes from the history that has been there for the last 40 or 50 years, especially after the Mossadegh incident. So that's there. That's what you call cultural background stuff. But about the media, definitely Iranians, I just wrote an article on the internet, the use of internet in Iran, definitely Iranians have access to BBC, to CNN, and of course the satellites. I mean, you go anywhere in Tehran and Iran, you have satellites. So definitely they're aware of the problems there. And at times, even I heard people say, again, we're talking about taxi drivers, that, you know, Ahmadinejad is going in a dangerous way. You know, Ahmadinejad, what he's doing, the kind of rhetoric, especially with the case of Israel, is kind of dangerous. Sure, I agree with him to a certain point, not regarding to the Holocaust issue, but definitely I think, you know, he's going the wrong way. So there are, it seems like they're getting some of the information from foreign media, especially Iranian dissident media that is very much based in Los Angeles and some parts of Europe. So there is an interesting awareness. It's not just simple blind nationalism, and they're not simply following the Ahmadinejad crowd, but definitely the nationalistic element is there. There's no way of denying it.
Babak, let me jump in and ask, to what extent do you see what's happening between Iran and the U.S. as linked to what's happening between Iraq and the U.S.?
Central. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that the U.S., one of the reasons why the administration decided to change its policy was because of Iraq. Not simply just because, you know, they're worried that Iranians will help some of these militia groups, especially Muqtada Saad's group, or the Scary faction, or even to appoint Fadila in southern Iraq in the city of Basra, to kind of create problems for the U.S. Army. But mostly they know Iranians could be a stabilizing force in Iraq for various reasons, especially economically. So they know that, you know, down the line, in fact, that's why they proposed to deal, to actually negotiate with Iran in the case of Iran in March, was because of the Iraq factor. That really, that has changed. The Iraq factor has changed U.S. foreign policy towards Iran. There's no way of denying that.
The U.S. keeps talking about how it's building this coalition of countries to participate in these diplomatic negotiations and how their focus is keeping this coalition together. But how can they say that they have this coalition of people who have agreed to negotiate if you're saying Russia is still helping with their nuclear program in Basra?
Sure. This recent agreement between these different six nation states is a very fragile one. And sure, all of them agree that Iran should become more transparent in regards to its development of nuclear technology. That's something that all agree. They're all worried about that Iran has been hiding some of its nuclear facilities for the last 18 years, 17 years. But I think fundamentally what they disagree is the method of stopping Iran. And sure, the recent development shows all of them want to go through the diplomatic process, but for certainly, Russia and China would not accept sanctions against Iran. So this is, I think, if the incentive package is rejected by Iran, I think you could probably see Russia and China kind of at the same time challenging the sanction option. And of course, we could see more increasing tension between the U.S. and China and Russia eventually. So
as we speak, Russia is still helping Russia.
Yeah, they are. They are. And the plan is that by the end of 2006, they will completely complete the development of the Bushehr nuclear facility.
In one of your recommendations,
so your name,
Vakov from Voice of America.
Okay.
You mentioned that the U.S. Your recommendation was that the U.S. should support growth democracy groups.
I didn't say that directly. I don't think I said that, did I? I hope I didn't. I could definitely talk about that, but please, I'm sorry.
Sure. It was one of your suggestions that the groups or pro-democracy groups should be supported, in my understanding, inside and outside Iran. Mm. And then later on, you eliminated some of the alternatives that were existed for other parties.
Sure.
Then who should be supported?
I don't think. I'm actually very cautious or skeptical about the U.S. actually directly dealing with some of the oppositional movements, both in Iran and outside of Iran. I don't think I said that in the presentation, so I hope we are clear. The reason why I say that is, first and foremost, I do want to make a serious argument that there is a dissident oppositional movement within Iran right now at this moment, and it is an organic one. And I think if the U.S. directly comes and negotiates and talks with some of them, those dissident movements will be seen and hampered or probably oppressed by the Iranian regime, saying that, look, you're a traitor, you're dealing with the U.S. So I think that would be a bad idea for the U.S. to actually come and, you know, actually help out these different dissident movements. And I think that's also the case with the Los Angeles media organizations, where they're getting a lot of money from the State Department. That's what I hear. And I think at this moment, a lot of Iranians who are actually opposed to the Iranian government are kind of looking down on these Iranians in Los Angeles. You know, they're like saying, what are you guys talking about? You guys have been living in Los Angeles for the last 20 years, eating your kebabs, and now you're telling us in Iran to have an uprising? I mean, so there is that interesting tension between Iranian dissident movements within Iran and the kind of foreign ones, Mr. Reza Pahlavi, who drinks, you know, his coffee at Starbucks in somewhere in Maryland, and the MKO, who basically runs around Washington, D.C. trying to gain support. And they have their own ideological agendas. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's a deep division between the domestic Iranian political dissident movement and the foreign ones. Yes?
What about Iranians who reach out to people outside for help?
That's fine. I think that's great. Oh, that's great. I mean,
the second thing I'd like to mention is that I did an article in my review, and I know what I wrote in the article. The last thing we wrote about was voluntary intervention. What we're talking about is the indigenous, as you just described, homegrown movement, or these various forms of nonviolent pressure, strikes, boycotts, mass protests, basically exploit the factions you just described. And the dissonance between those factions. So be careful, I think, about who you're attributing a desire to desire for military intervention too. I'm sure there are people here who do have that desire, do advocate that, but not everyone. The third point I would say is that in my experience, and I think it's confirmed with what happened in North Korea, is that a policy of only carrots and sticks defined as the withdrawal of carrots is the policy which P5 or the EU3 or the United States, when they settle, will only have to repay and repay again. It's a formula for the continuous payment of good behavior. So there's going to have to be some element of sanctions or defined, however you define, basically conscribed to give a reason that's a negative incentive against behavior that's unacceptable to those Iran is negotiating with now. The withdrawal of carrots. So maybe you can think a little bit more about
what that might look like. I don't think it's a matter of withdrawal of sticks. Definitely, I think the sticks should be there. But what I suggested here was that the incentives and the military intervention does not work. That's the point I was trying to make. Perhaps there are other options for sticks. Again, this is something I still do not, I haven't come up with one at this moment. I'll be very honest about it. But I'm not denying that sticks is bad. But I do say that definitely the kind of rhetoric should be lowered down. I think definitely the tone should be lowered down for obvious pragmatic reasons, not for anything idealistic here. Second of all, about the Iranian indigenous democratic movement, certainly, that has been there for decades. You know, I had Mr. Gordon Gray, the secretary's deputy, I forget what his title was, from the State Department, come to San Diego, and one of the points he's made is that, well, what we need to do is go, well, actually help out this Iranian civil society in Iran to start building it. Excuse me? Have you read the Iranian history for the last decades? The Iranian Constitutional Revolution 1906, which right now we are celebrating, it's centennial, whatever. What we are seeing is that the civil society in Iran has been in existence since the late 19th century. The Iranian Revolution, whether you like it or not, it was based on a civic associational movement that really combined different ethnic and religious and also gender aspects. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there is a strong civil society in Iran. Sure, at this moment it's subdued, but let's not simply ignore it and say that, well, let's start building it. At least we should get to know Iranian history before we make any suggestions to making or building civil society in Iran.
Babak, you haven't commented on this, but I wonder if you would. The question of ethnic minorities in Iran may be somewhat unrelated to the nuclear question, but particularly as we've had some visits recently from people who describe themselves as being from Eastern Kurdistan. I'm curious to hear your comment on
It's there. The ethnic separatist movement has been there for decades, especially in Kurdistan. And recently what we are seeing is that, not in Azerbaijan, but in Baluchistan, is right now it's kind of developing and it's becoming more powerful. The one in Khuzestan, the Arab Iranians, it's a minority movement. It doesn't have that much force, but it's still there as well. I would say at this stage, what has contributed to the kind of ethnic tension in Iran has to do directly with the Iraq situation, especially with the increasing Turkish independence in the north of Iraq. And I think that definitely has had a spillover effect of, you know, kind of encouraging and motivating course in Iran. But I think that's the limit of the ethnic separatist movement in Iran. You don't see it in the so-called Arabistan or Khuzestan region, and the Baluchi separatist movement is still limited.
The Azeris?
The Azeris, you know, there was a recent interesting incident where I think an Iranian newspaper had a depiction of an Azeri person depicted in the form of a cockroach, and that angered a lot of Azeris. As far as I know, there is no actual serious movement from the Azeri province in fighting against the regime to create its own independence. But I'm sure there are dissident movements that are dispersed and decentralized at this moment. But Kurdistan is really the main province at this stage.
Kamran? Yeah, Babak, Kamran Huda, U.S. Institute of Peace. I wanted to ask about the views on the ground in Iran about the uranium enrichment program. The government says it's for scientific development and for civilian purposes, to develop energy resources. And other folks say it's for defense purposes to develop the nuclear weapon. What are the views on the ground, and how much do they buy into the Iranian message of this is for civilian purposes?
They don't. That's what's interesting.
And if you could tell me the different
views.
And I have a second follow-up question, which is the infamous letter by the president. Could you
actually,
say
I think the letter was
the letter?
Cute, but
yeah. Could you say something about the cute letter and ask whether that letter is going to lead to maybe some steps to official recognition of diplomatic ties? Because as of now, you're asking for, you know, talks and so forth, but there's no official diplomatic
yeah.
ties. So how
well,
do you initiate?
Well, one of the
that?
Arguments is that, again, answer your second question. One of the arguments is that Ahmadinejad's letter was actually a symbolic signification that Iran wants to negotiate. And of course, apparently the administration saw it as a positive, even though publicly they said it's meaningless, but apparently they saw it as a positive move. So I think it did play a kind of a role, but to me, when I read it, I was laughing, quite frankly. At the same time, there were some problematic parts of the letter, don't get me wrong. But it was just really, to me, I was like, it was funny how Ahmadinejad was preaching to Mr. Bush, who himself, I guess you could say, is very much of a preacher himself. So. But anyway, regarding your first question, look, I think Iranians, I mean, again, I don't want to generalize, but I'm talking about the ones that are mostly living outside of Tehran, because Tehran itself is a different world. But most of them very much are celebrate the idea of possibility Iran could have a nuclear bomb. Again, the whole nationalistic sentiment is very much there. In the city of Tehran, and they do not buy in the argument that Iran is only doing this for civilian purposes. They don't, as far as the ones I talk to. In Tehran, however, things are different. When you go to the north of Tehran, which is the more well-to-do part of the city, definitely you hear a lot of skeptical arguments that, first of all, you know, the Iran is going for the nuclear bomb, and that's not a good thing. It's nothing to celebrate. But at the same time, I have heard many Iranians who actually, Tehranians who actually come from the northern part. And at the same time, they hate the Ahmadinejad regime, but at the same time, they celebrate the idea that Iran would one day have a nuclear bomb. So we're talking about a very messy picture, but I would say, generally speaking, many Iranians support Iran's development of nuclear technology. In fact, the Iranian government knows that, and they're very much capitalizing on the nationalistic sentiment in Iran.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Given what you just said about the nationalistic support for the nuclear program, and the opening comments about the sense of threat that the Iranians could see, one, do you believe they are really be prepared to negotiate away their nuclear program?
Mm.
And if not, what is the character of the negotiation that is, there are many reasons to negotiate, one of which is just to fend off pressures.
Mm.
One would be to solve the problem through a collaborative way. But I'd just be interested in your view of whether you think the nuclear issue, same thing with North Korea,
mm.
do you think they would, in this case, the Iranians, be willing to trade, in effect, their nuclear program for these various incentives? And if not, what's the character of the negotiation?
I think the Iranian government, we're talking about especially the hardline conservatives, they know that they could lose a lot by negotiations. And they're very much, this is my hunch, my impression is that they're very much pushing, especially the spiritual leader, Mr. Ayatollah Khamenei, not to negotiate with the U.S. They would lose a lot. They would lose, again, I just talked about the ideological stuff, and they would compromise a lot about their own basis in the Iranian country. So I think what we could see is that there might be, again, this is, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but there could be some backdoor negotiations that we might actually see in the next few weeks. I mean, this is what happened during the 1980s when the Reagan administration was actually dealing with the Iranian government. If so, who's doing the negotiations, I wouldn't know. But probably the Guardian, the Revolutionary Guards, will have a major role in negotiations. I'm sorry, you know, I should have...
But have they made an irreversible decision to get nuclear weapons?
I'm sorry?
Have they made an irreversible decision to get nuclear weapons?
No, I think they are open. I think they're definitely open to change their minds. I think so. Because to a certain extent, I'm not just talking about the Revolutionary Guards, I'm also talking about the pragmatist conservatives. They very much are seeing that this could be a way of gaining economic benefits for the Iranians and, of course, themselves as well. So they're seeing some benefits here. But I think what worries me at this moment are the Revolutionary Guards, who are seeing this negotiation as just a ploy and also a way to undermine their power in the Iranian government. I don't know if I answered your question, though. Did I? No, I didn't. Okay.
He was asking if you think they're willing to negotiate away their nuclear program, and you haven't.
Okay. I think ultimately I think with this case of the Revolutionary Guards, the most important thing would be security guarantees. They're not really interested about economic stuff. So I think ultimately if the U.S. and, of course, the other countries could guarantee their security, the military security, yes, I think they will negotiate and do away with the nuclear technology and compromise. But that's the only thing, I think, with the I think with regard to the incentive package, the security inducement is what they are really interested in. And sure, I think they would eventually negotiate and do away with the nuclear technology. Yes?
You've raised the green flag there, not really interested in the economic side.
The Revolution Guards.
All right, they are not. Mm. But the governments as such, are they not attracted by the European package?
My hunch is that, again, we're talking about pragmatic conservatives and also the reformists. Some of them are still in the Iranian government. They are interested, but I don't think the Revolution Guards are interested at this stage. This is my, again, I'm talking about my hunch because I don't exactly know these people. I haven't talked to them. But my impression by reading the articles and their articles in their hardline and conservative newspaper, my hunch is that they're not interested in this. In fact, I have one copy of a, where did I put it? Here we go. This is a good example of it right here from the Boss Top news site. And this guy very much, this one guy, his name is, I believe, Rasul Jafar, and very much articulates that position, that, you know, we're going to lose a lot by this by this incentive package. So.
John Christ with the Institute of Peace. Babak, just as background to these questions that have been raised about trading away the nuclear program, how strong is the case for the need for nuclear power for domestic purposes? How does that fit in with plans for economic development? What are the, you know, I don't know how you measure all these things, but what is the percentage of this power that could be conceivably attributed to use for domestic peaceful purposes? Could you say more about it?
I wouldn't know about that. Right. We're talking about technical scope. I really wouldn't know. But definitely I know at least back in the 50s, the Shah's government saw some major benefits by having a nuclear technology in Iran's economic infrastructure. And I don't see how the current Iranian government would see anything would oppose that kind of agenda.
So the usual argument for domestic nuclear weapons or nuclear power is an economic argument.
Sure, of course. Well, the argument is that by 2020, Iran's oil resources will be running out of that.
Yeah.
So that's the main argument, that we need to have this for simply energy purposes. And of course, the level that practically they could actually use that, apply that, I wouldn't know about that. I wouldn't know. That's a good question, though.
First, Iran has said they would respond to the U.S. by August 22nd.
Mm.
Do you know why August
22nd? It beats me. Maybe it's Alan's birthday. I don't know.
And you said, you know, the first step would be having negotiations without boundaries, without a deadline.
Without conditions,
Without conditions. Should those negotiations sort of go on indefinitely until...
No, indefinitely, but I think the first stage should be that the U.S. should just start negotiating with Iran. And I think that in itself could be a positive step forward at this moment. Again, we don't know what's going to happen at the end, but at least it's a positive step.
Is there, at any point, a definition or a way of saying, okay, we tried negotiations and it failed? How do you make that determination?
That's something up to the diplomats to make down the road in case they do come to the negotiating table. I personally wouldn't know. But I would say this, though, that, you know, we should, whatever it is, I think the international community, and that would, of course, include the U.S., should not give up on diplomacy. Whatever it takes, they should push it. Whatever it is, because unfortunately at this moment Iran has the upper hand, because they know first of all that the U.S. cannot do anything with the sanctions and the military intervention. They know that, so then they know the only option is the diplomatic one. And at this time, we're talking about how the conservatives are trying to negotiate this among themselves. They're probably at this time they're saying that, wait, you know what? We're going to play this game all the way to see how much we can milk the cow, how much we could get out of this. So maybe this whole rhetoric of, you know, what you just heard, what Khamenei said about how it doesn't benefit Iran, it would be just bluffing. They're just trying to see how far they could, you know, take this diplomatic route and how much they could actually benefit from this economically. So again, this is why I'm constantly saying that it's a confusing, messy situation, because I don't think anyone here, including me, knows exactly what's going on in Tehran. I don't think even those Iranian politicians know what's going on in Tehran. So again, we're talking about a very, you know, confusing situation at this moment, uncertain situation.
Further
questions?
Sure, my name is Hanus Nakano. I'm a former Peace Fellow of Brookings. 24 years ago, in summer 1981, I was working in Baghdad. The Israeli fighter attacked Iraqi nuclear power plant.
Okay.
Are there any possibilities of Israel fighter attacking Iran?
Yeah,
attack Iran nuclear power.
At this moment, I don't think. I think what I read is that even Israelis encourage the U.S. administration to directly negotiate with Iran. And also, they know Iran is not Iraq. So I think the Israelis are aware if they do suddenly, well, at this moment, if they do attack Iran's nuclear facilities, it will create a lot of problems in the region. But again, I'm not ruling out the Israeli option, and I don't rule it out at this moment. But I wouldn't rule it out in the future. But at this moment, I don't think they would do that. They have the Revolutionary Guard, the one I just showed you, the whole, and again, I'm going to emphasize on that's going to be a central political factor in this whole thing. They have actually think tanks in Tehran. They have their own think tanks, just like the USIP. And one of them, all it does is simply monitors and studies U.S. politics. Who's involved, the State Department, they know probably a lot of things that, you know, a lot of us here wouldn't know. So that's interesting, but that's an interesting recent development. They actually set up these think tanks after 2000, which again goes to show this interesting link with the tension between the reformers and conservatives, how the Revolution Guards have gained a lot of power. This is a good example of it. And they're very much aware that in order for them to fight their enemy, which is the U.S., they need to know the enemy first. So.
Just a little more philosophical question. Every nation, it seems, needs to have a sense of its identity, its purpose, and why it is there, its reason for being. I mean, Rome was going to bring law and order. The U.S. is a light to the world of justice and peace. Britain to bring civilization and God to India and Africa. Every nation has this sort of what the Greeks called telos, or inner drive, and that when that is undercut or taken away, then it creates a great deal of uncertainty, a feeling that we are not accepted, we do not accept ourselves, and it leads to a great deal of behavior that is
accepted
very,
by who? Accepted
by
us or
by the world,
people?
By people in the world. One has to accept the fact that a nation has a sense of its own identity, its purpose, its mission, and so forth. Just as a bottom line, in the case of North Korea, although I agree with what was said earlier, that one cannot keep falling into that trap, I say to myself, it's just like this insecure country whose identity has been taken away. You get pushed into a corner, and what are you going to do? You're going to lash out in a very irresponsible way. What if... on a policy front, one acknowledged the existence of the DPRK, called it by its name, North Korea.
Oh, no, okay.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
Sure.
But if you said, we will talk to you, we will negotiate. In fact, we will end the Korean War. We'll sign some peace agreement, which has never really been done. Mm. That would be a bold diplomatic move. It might not alleviate all the insecurity of Kim Jong-il and company, but it would introduce an avenue through which lots of other things could happen, like they are happening in Iran already.
Well, wouldn't that legitimize the government that was not elected by the people and is there as an authoritarian
force? In a sense, it would. But... in realpolitik, one has to acknowledge, I think, the status quo and say, okay, we acknowledge your existence, and now from here we move into the future together. And I think one could really, even in the case of North Korea, one could introduce exchanges and students and theater, just like has been happening in Iran. But I would favor that policy also with respect to Iran. Maybe that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I do want to emphasize is that I do not think that national identity is monolithic, and I don't think the rhetoric we're hearing from Tehran about Iran's national identity is representative of the multiplicity and the heterogeneous identity of the Iranian people. Again, we're talking about Azeris, Kurds, Baluchis, and we're talking about a very diverse country. And I don't think there is one ideology or one national identity, or Telius would call it, that would define Iranian national identity. However, on a real political pragmatic side, perhaps, again, I don't want to suggest that, but perhaps that's one way of doing, you know, starting the negotiations to recognize the Iranian government. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm talking about the U.S. administration, and at least move on with the negotiations to stop the Iran's nuclear technology.
What would happen to democratic movements in Iran if we recognize the Iranian government?
You know, the U.S. government recognized Shah's regime, and we had a huge democratic uprising. Sure, it was stolen and taken away by certain Islamist factors, but definitely we did have a democratic movement in the 60s and 70s in Iran without the support of the U.S. government. So I guess my point is that I don't think to bring democracy in Iran in its organic sense, I don't think the U.S. should or does play a major role in that process. I don't think so. Again, people compare the situation with Eastern Europe. I think the Iranian case is a bit different, you know. And I think if there's going to be any important fundamental change in Iranian politics on a democratic aspect, it will come many years to come. It will not happen in the next 5 or 4 years, which some of the people have been suggesting, by the way, in some think tanks in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to close today's session. I invite you to continue your conversations with Dr. Rahimi. He will be here for the next couple of months, although he has a pretty rigorous travel schedule. And I'd also like to invite you for next week's Senior Fellow Report by Anatoly Adamishin and Richard Shifter on the USSR, U.S. Human Rights Dialogue in the 1980s. It'll be the same time next week at 12:30 on Thursday, and hope you can come. Thank you for your time.